Good afternoon, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here and talk about one of my favorite fruits, which is a strawberry. And my goal today is to give you a broad overview of strawberry nutrition and how it's managed in a perennial strawberry, not so much the annual strawberry. I want to try to answer a little bit all these questions that you see up here. And obviously, I can't spend a lot of time on any one, but I'll try to give you a snapshot response to all of these. Okay. And the first question is, you know, why is strawberry in the, amongst this group of vulnerable woody plants like blackberries and blueberries and all? Why is a strawberry part of this? And the reason is, well, strawberry is really a woody plant too, and most people don't think of it as that. But the strawberry crown is actually a short woody stem. And we tend not to grow our strawberries for enough years to really see that. But Darrow reported in his book in 1966 that if you go to California and look at some of those Chilowensis clones on the coast, you can have a 2-foot-long crown, woody crown. So the tendency of a strawberry is to be a woody plant. And it has the typical patterns of starch mobilization that you would find in a woody plant as well. In other words, you know, in the fall and winter, starch is at the highest levels, it's depleted during the winter, and then it increases again in the following fall. So what's the general approach to managing nutrition in strawberry? How do we do this in perennial strawberry? Well, the general approach is sort of twofold. One is, before your plants are in the ground, you do a soil test and try to bring that soil test up to a reasonable level and then plant your strawberries, and then follow those for several years in this perennial system, and then use a leaf analysis every 2 or 3 years after that to make sure you're within a proper range. And that's typically what we recommend the growers do. And strawberries don't live for 50 years. You know, we might fruit them for 3 or 4 or 5 years, so we can go back in and do another soil test the next time we replant. We don't rely on visual symptoms because, you know, if you wait till you see something wrong with the plant visually, you've already, it's too late. Things should have been corrected sooner. The goals of soil testing at first step is to estimate plant available nutrient levels. You all know this, and there's different soil testing extractants that are used around the country, and different labs use different ones. So those of you who are in extension and you're working with growers have to know that you can't use the soil results from one lab and recommendations from another lab and put them together because they sometimes don't match because the recommendations are extractant based. And no extractant is perfect, so certain labs use the ones they have the most experience with, develop recommendations based on those extractants, and that's what are given to growers. But they can't be interchanged, so that's just something to keep in mind. And again, the soil tests are useful for phosphorus, potassium, magnesium, calcium, and boron, and they're not much use for other soil nutrients. What we want to do when we get our soil tests back is we want to make sure that we apply enough so that we're in this range here and not too little and not too much where we're in excess, but right at that sort of optimum level where the plants perform their best and are not limited by that nutrient. These are some examples of what strawberries look like if they don't have sufficient nutrients. If you look in the upper left-hand corner, that's what potassium deficiency looks like in a strawberry. Upper right, phosphorus. Lower left, magnesium, and lower right, calcium. Now, I mentioned we recommend growers use soil tests, but one thing to keep in mind is that soil tests aren't necessarily the most reliable predictors of plant nutrient status. And you get back these results, they all look very scientific, and it convinces you, oh, we know exactly what to apply, and everything's cool, but it's really not the case. And there's lots of reasons why that is. That soil tests don't necessarily reflect plant nutrient status. And here's a list of 5 right here. And David already talked about pH effects and how you can have the nutrients in the soil, but if the pH isn't in the right range, the plant can't take it up, and therefore the plant may show a deficiency. Drought has an impact as well. Situations where the plants aren't getting enough water, particularly for nutrients that move into the plant through mass flow, if you don't have enough water, the plant could be deficient even though there's adequate amounts in the soil. And sometimes you see that for potassium where it's been dry, grower hasn't irrigated a lot, so potassium calcium is low in the plant because of insufficient irrigation. Disease can have an impact. Nutrient interactions and boron status. I want to give you a couple of examples. Dave talked about that, so we'll skip that. I want to talk about pathogens in the soil for a second. Usually you would think that if you have a pathogen in the soil, that inhibits nutrient uptake. And generally it does, because it destroys the root tips oftentimes, and there's not enough surface area for the plants to take up those nutrients, particularly those that require root-soil contact for good uptake. But we've done some work with Rhizoctonia, and under cool conditions where Rhizoctonia doesn't do quite as well, and it's sort of at a low level, sort of a sublethal level, we've actually found increased nutrient uptake when plants are infected with Rhizoctonia when the temperatures are cool. And this has been shown in some other plants as well, that the Rhizoctonia almost acts like a mycorrhizal fungus and actually helps the plant acquire nutrients when it's cool. Now, when the weather gets warm, the Rhizoctonia proliferates more and it can actually start to damage the plants. But it's kind of interesting, at low levels, it actually does enhance nutrient uptake. We talked a little bit about boron, about nutrient interactions before. Oftentimes we find that nutrients aren't as high in the plant as we think they should be based on the soil test because boron is low. And this is an example of what happens in a strawberry when it has insufficient boron. The plant on the left has adequate boron, the plant on the right, boron was withheld, and you can see that it causes root tips to abort. And the plant on the right obviously isn't able to take up not just boron but other nutrients because it just doesn't have the surface area that it would if it has adequate boron. So that's one thing that we often check whenever we're looking at soil test results with growers is what's the boron level. So if you look at the soil and the leaf analysis, you can sometimes see that. This is an example of a strawberry soil test and leaf analysis result that we got back this year, and we looked at it, and the soil was showing adequate potassium and phosphorus and calcium, but the leaves were showing low levels. And when you go down and look at the boron, sure enough, boron was low as well, and that's reflected in both the, and that's reflected in the leaf analysis results. So boron is one of those we pay particular attention to because it can affect the uptake of the other nutrients. This is some work we did quite a while ago on different levels of phosphorus and boron in the soil. We looked at nutrient responses to these. And what we found was that when boron was low, we could add lots of phosphorus to the soil and not get a positive yield response. It was only when boron was high, which is that green level, and high by high I mean adequate levels, that we actually saw a positive response to boron or to phosphorus. So you have to have adequate boron to get positive responses to these other nutrients, or you'll get these funky results where the soil test will show high levels, but it won't be reflected in the plant. So what are typical fertilization practices and rates in strawberry, and how is that different than annual strawberries? As I mentioned before, we use soil tests as a guide to incorporate the nutrients. Prior to planting, we have a target pH of 6.2 to 6.5, so we're within that range that David talked about, where uptake is good for strawberries. We apply nitrogen according to standard practices, and we make adjustments with leaf analysis. So I already talked about that. One thing to keep in mind is that not all nutrients are taken up into the plant in exactly the same way. There's three modes of uptake: root interception, mass flow, and diffusion. Mass flow is when the nutrient is dissolved in the water and it's taken up by the plant as the plant transpires and it pulls the nutrient into the plant. That's the primary method that nitrogen gets taken up into the plant. 99% of nitrogen in a plant gets taken up through mass flow. Other nutrients don't get taken up by mass flow very much. Like look at P, look at phosphorus. Not much by mass flow. It's mostly taken up by diffusion, which means you have to have pretty close root soil contact for that phosphorus to diffuse into the root. So if you look at this, you can tell right away why we recommend incorporating P and K into the soil before you plant, because mostly that's taken up by diffusion. So you have to have good mixture in the soil and good root soil contact for that to be taken up. If you put phosphorus on the soil surface and hope that it washes in with rainfall or irrigation and gets taken up by mass flow like nitrogen can, that's not going to happen. So it's important to keep in mind how these nutrients are taken up into the plant so we know how to manage them appropriately. That's why we don't, you know, you get your pH back and it's 5.2 and it's a strawberry field. You don't decide after the plants are in the ground it's time to lime the plants. You do that before you plant so the pH is right before you plant, because this isn't going to work into the ground very quickly and modify the soil pH. Just a little bit about annual and perennial management. This talks mostly on perennials, but we want to compare it to annuals just so you have a sense of how they differ. Annual strawberries, I think of almost growing them and fertilizing them like a vegetable crop. You know, you can feed them almost every week with the precise amount that they need, and you do that on an annual basis, then you're done and you can start over again. Perennial crop strategy is a little bit different, and we want to build reserves in the soil and build up the plant a little bit, because they don't have this continuous production cycle. They have these very distinct cycles of, you know, flowering and fruiting and rapid growth, of starch accumulation, of dormancy, and it's not the same every week of the year like it is where annual strawberries are grown. So the strategy is a little bit different, where we want to think about building reserves and not getting things too high or too low in the plant during that period of time. These are some data from annual strawberry production from Watsonville, looking at nitrogen rates in selected fields out there. And these are some random fields that Mark Bolda published the fertilization strategy on. And you can see it's really hard to make any generalizations about how annual strawberries are fertilized. They both pre-plant incorporate nitrogen, and they both fertigate nitrogen. And the numbers and the proportion between incorporation and fertigation are all over the place. They jump all over. And generally, the average is about 211 pounds of nitrogen per acre, but it really varies a lot. With perennial strawberry, growers tend to do the same thing a little bit more consistently. The typical thing that growers would do would be, you know, 30 pounds a few weeks after planting, followed by another 30 pounds in September. And in the second year and beyond, you know, renovation, put down maybe 70 pounds and another 30 pounds in September. And there may be some adjustments later on in the fall with leaf analysis. So about 100 pounds of actual nitrogen per year, per acre, on perennial strawberries. Pretty typical. So I talked about soil testing and why that's not always the best indicator, but it's the best one we have at the moment. The other indicator we have are leaf analysis. And one big question we have is when to sample leaves for nutrient recommendations. Dave showed you a bunch of numbers up there on the screen for all the different fruit crops, and those are numbers, but when were those numbers taken, and what's the most appropriate time to take that? For strawberry, typically it's been recommended that you take the first new leaves after renovation. So the leaves are mowed off after harvest. The new leaves come up. Those are the ones that you take for leaf analysis that reflect the nutrient status of the plant. And the reason we choose that time of the year is because nutrient levels tend to be relatively stable at that time. They're not fluctuating up and down so much. If you look at, take one nutrient like boron and look at the values of the leaves from the beginning of the season in spring till fall, you can see that boron levels actually start off high in the spring and they drop during the season and they don't start to flatten out until later on in the summer. So we sample leaves in that lower end when we get those ranges between 20 and 30 parts per million that say you're adequate, but that's only because it's that time of the year. So these leaf analysis values are calibrated for certain times of the year, and generally we pick times when the levels are flat and not jumping up and down so much. Strawberry plant, you know, grows really rapidly, particularly in the springtime. So that first half of the graph there is planting year. Second half of the graph is springtime, April, May, and June, and there's just an awful lot of growth happening then. It's a very challenging time to interpret anything with leaf nutrient levels, because the plant's growing so rapidly, levels are fluctuating all over the place. Not a good time to sample. We wait until things start to flatten out, we're done with fruiting, and that's when the levels are more stable. And that's when we get these critical ranges for the nutrients that we talked about earlier. But I think one of the research challenges that we have is, you know, what time of the year is best to sample for each of these essential nutrients? Is it always, like early August, always the best time? That's when we do it. That's when these values have been calibrated for, but is that the best time? Maybe it is better to sample leaves in the springtime for boron. And no one has really done those studies to figure out when's the best time to do that. It's all sort of based on what's been done in the past and what healthy fields look like at that time of the year, but no one has really done the detailed analysis to see what is the best time to sample for the best reflection. And then just as with soil, where we talked about soil tests don't always reflect plant nutrient levels, leaf analysis doesn't always do that either. And there are some reasons why that can be the case. There's a pH effect of the soil on leaf nutrient levels. We already talked about that. Temporal variation levels, we gave you some examples of that already. There's a fruiting effect. Right after harvest, oftentimes plants are low in potassium, even though potassium is adequate in the soil, and it will become adequate again. The plant just has to recover from producing all that fruit that has a lot of potassium in it. We have nutrient interactions going on in the leaves, and a leaf analysis measures certain forms of nutrients that aren't always the most active form or isn't biologically active. And iron is a good example of that. You can have iron available in the ferric form, but that's not an active form of iron. It's a ferrous form, and usually the ICPs that measure these things don't distinguish between the two. Here's an example of tissue boron in various plant parts and what goes on during the year. And you can see that it starts off high and drops down. I already showed that before, but the various plant parts show different patterns. So again, one of the questions you would have is, what plant part do we sample to get the best indicator plant nutrient status? Here's calcium. Again, four different plant parts, four different patterns of fluctuation within the plant. Which one do we use? And what time of the year is best to use it? Again, there's so many factors in here playing a role that it's really difficult to answer that question with precision. So another research challenge is which plant part is most representative of plant nutrient status. Another thing that happens with leaf analysis, particularly if you're deficient, it's possible that if you're at that low end where you have low levels of nutrient and it's limiting plant growth, and you add that limiting nutrient, you get a flush of growth in the plant in response to that that actually dilutes the levels in the tissue because you've gotten rapid growth. So you can actually, in situations where you're low levels, when you add a nutrient, you can actually see a result in lower levels in the leaf from the result of adding that nutrient. And that's called the Steinberg effect, and it does happen occasionally. Another example where leaf analysis isn't always the best indicator of what the nutrient status is in a plant. So some additional research challenges. Is leaf nutrient content the best indicator of a plant's nutrient status, or are there other indicators that would be better? One of the things we're thinking about looking at is sap analysis. And a lot of people have used sap analysis for vegetable crops and so forth, but the problem with that is that the concentration in the sap varies a lot based on whether you've just recently irrigated or whether it's rained or so forth like that, because you know the water moves into the plant. But we're playing around with looking at it as a ratio of the nutrient in the sap relative to the carbon. And the carbon levels kind of fluctuate with the water levels, so it gives you a relative indicator of how much nutrient is available in the plant relative to the amount of carbon. And the technology just now available to be able to do that relatively inexpensively. So we're going to be looking at that and seeing whether that might be better than just looking at leaves at one time of the year. And the other thing we're looking at, we want to ask, is what are the most important nutrient interactions to examine? Showed you already how boron and phosphorus interact, that if you don't have enough boron in the soil, you don't get a response to phosphorus. There's that interaction going on there. What are some other nutrients that interact? And with 13, 14 essential nutrients in a plant, you do that little factorial thing there. There's a lot of potential nutrient interactions that could be at play that we may not be aware of. All right, so changing gears a little bit. Are strawberry plants limited by carbon, by nitrogen, or by both? Some simple experiments, enriching strawberries with CO2 in the fall and looking to yield the following spring. Simple experiment graduate student did a few years ago, and yes, when you enrich strawberries with supplemental CO2, you can get a 15% increase in yield, suggesting that carbon might be limiting. If you look at biomass of various plant parts over time, this would be like from the winter, midwinter into the spring, you can see that the roots lose carbon quite a bit during that wintertime period when they're covered with mulch. The other plant parts, not so much, but roots definitely see a decline in carbon, and that's reflected in starch as well. So starch levels decline during the winter when the plants are cold or covered with mulch for the winter. And in the springtime then, if you enrich in the springtime, you also see a response to supplemental CO2. So we saw the same thing in the fall, we see the same thing in the spring. Elevate the CO2, photosynthetic rate goes up, it's also reflected in higher yields. And a second experiment, same thing, add extra CO2, yields go up, add extra light, yields go up. So strawberries, at least in our part of the country, in the Northeast, seem to be carbon limited for much of the year. And when you correlate yield with total non-structural carbohydrates, you see a very nice correlation showing that the more carbon the plant has, the more total carbon, the more the yield is. So anything we can do to enhance the carbon reserves in the plant seems to be reflected in higher yield. So we have strong evidence that plants are carbon limited. But now let's look at nitrogen. These are jewel strawberry plants that were received various amounts of nitrogen for the first growing year, and then we followed them into the second year looking at photosynthetic rate, starch levels, yields, and so forth. Also, in that first year in the fall, some of the plants received supplemental foliar fertilization. And then some of those plants in the spring received supplemental nitrogen fertilization in the spring. So these plants at different rates of nitrogen, some received supplemental fall fertilization, and some received supplemental spring fertilization. The fall fertilization was a foliar application. The spring fertilization was ground-applied fertilizer. Let's look at some of the patterns that we see in here. On the lower axis there, as the nitrogen levels go up, on the top axis there, the total dry weight of the plant goes up. You know, no surprise there. And when you add, you get an enhancement if you add fertigation in the fall. And that pattern's reflected whether the plants receive spring nitrogen or not. So you see this increase. More nitrogen, greater plant growth. Not surprising. But what we did find is that the photosynthetic rates kind of peak out at sort of a minimal, a medium level of nitrogen. That if you keep adding nitrogen to the plants, you might get bigger plants, but the plants aren't photosynthesizing at a higher rate. The plants sort of peaked out here at our 10N level. And it's hard to correlate our fertigation rates with what you would apply in the soil because these plants are in pots, not in the field. But we tried to pick a level that was sort of in between sort of a modest level of nutrition. But the point is here that you can reach a point where adding additional nitrogen doesn't give you higher photosynthetic rate. And we look at various plant parts under these different nitrogen rates. What we see is that you put on lots of nitrogen on your plant, and you can grow the plant to be very big. You got lots of leaf area on that plant, but your yields only go up a small amount. So if you want to grow big, bushy plants, you put the nitrogen on, but you're not necessarily going to get higher yields from those bigger plants. And when we do this graph of total nitrogen versus yield, unlike the carbon, where we saw a continuous linear contribution, the more nitrogen we added, the or the more carbon that we added to the plant, the higher the yield. In this case here, we sort of reach a plateau with the nitrogen. So additional nitrogen doesn't always result in increased yield, and an optimal nitrogen status depends on the carbohydrate status. And what we see here is sort of this inverse relationship between nitrogen and starch, or nitrogen and carbohydrate in strawberry plants. When nitrogen goes up, carbohydrate levels go down, and vice versa. And here's an example in two cultivars, Jewel and Seascape, a day neutral and a June bearing strawberry, and they both respond the same way. If we look at starch levels in these plants where we added various amounts of nitrogen to them, in the top graph there, that's roots, crowns, and leaves in December. But as you go into the springtime, you can see that in that lower graph there, that the roots definitely show lower starch levels the more nitrogen they received in the fall. So again, what's going on here is that when plants take up nitrogen, it requires carbon to take up that nitrogen and metabolize that carbon and make amino acids. So the more you force a plant to take up nitrogen, you're decreasing carbohydrate reserves. And you can reach a point where you actually put those carbohydrate reserves below the point of where you get optimal yield. And here's kind of an example of that. Fertigation at various rates. With foliar urea, you can really sort of increase the yield, but you can go overboard on that and actually start dropping yields back down again because your carbon and nitrogen aren't in balance as they need to be in these plants. So can nitrogen levels be too high? Yes. If carbohydrate levels are low, high nitrogen will not increase yield and actually may decrease yield. Spring nitrogen increases vegetative growth but has little impact on yield. We've done work where if you put more than 30 pounds of actual nitrogen in a plant in the springtime, you get big plants, but you don't get much of an increase in yield, and actually your gray mold goes up as well, and your fruit gets a little bit softer because you're growing the plant vegetatively when you apply nitrogen in the spring, as opposed to increasing your fruiting capacity when it's applied in the fall. So another research opportunity is how does one assess the carbon status of the plant in order to determine the appropriate rate of nitrogen to apply? We don't have really good ways of doing that. They're doing some of that work with apples and modeling carbon supply for thinning in the spring, but we really need something like that for strawberry to model nitrogen. What percent of nitrogen is applied nitrogen is taken up by the plant? We've looked at applying nitrogen at various months of the year, sampling at various times, looking at what percent of that applied nitrogen goes into the various plant parts. It's almost always the case that the roots take up nitrogen, and mostly they're taking it up in the fall. And percent in from fertilizer, again, most of the percent taken up by the roots is happening in the fall. And my last question is, when is the most effective time to apply nitrogen, fall or spring? I mentioned that the roots are most actively taking up nitrogen in the fall. We looked at fruiting affected by fall foliar nitrogen. 5 pounds of fall foliar nitrogen, you get this bump in yield with the fall foliar nitrogen. Yield response to fall foliar sprays, you get a bump in yield. Spring nitrogen, tiny little bump in yield, but here we're putting on 30 pounds per acre as opposed to 5 pounds per acre. Again, we look at berries per plant, just a little bit of a bump from spring nitrogen, but a big bump from the fall. And here you can see the comparison. The yield increase can be about the same, but in one case you're using 5 pounds of nitrogen, in the other case you're using 30. So clearly, plants are most efficient at using nitrogen in the fall as opposed to the spring. So the last research opportunity, what's the balance between soil and foliar applications in the fall to most efficiently increase plant nitrogen status, minimize environmental impact, and what are the conditions under which spring N might be warranted? Because growers are definitely putting on spring N, sort of against our advice, but they're convinced that it makes a difference. So last slide, conclusions. Soil tests coupled with leaf analysis are still the best tools that growers have for managing nutrients in perennial strawberries, but there's many opportunities to fine-tune these tools or develop other ways of assessing plant nutrient status. And nitrogen used in excess can actually decrease yields and be harmful and can have a negative impact on carbohydrate status as well. So here are some citations that we use for this paper if you want to go back and look at the data. And that'll be in the presentation that's available on the web. So thank you.